Hello, this is D. Roberts Keenan with Smart TV, talking to you again about the seven deadly sins. Today we're going to be discussing Murphy Brown and how it relates to the number two most deadly sin, envy, which you might also know under the name jealousy. I hope you've got your DVD queued up. We are watching Season 1, Episode 13, Soul Man. If you've got the DVDs, it is the first episode on the third disc. Right now we're watching Charles Kimbrough as Jim Dial in a cute little opening bit about, you know, pouring his coffee. This is sort of setting up the tradition that he follows every morning. It's clear he has this routine, and that idea of tradition becomes a little bit more important a little later on in the episode. This is an episode about tradition and the breaking down of tradition, specifically about how Murphy, played by Candace Bergen, is jealous of this tradition of an all-men's club. And here we're establishing with, you know, the characters of Frank Fontana and Jim Dial, this idea of the really great club that women just can't get into. And of course, this is going to fuel Murphy's jealousy. There are a couple of other moments of envy that pop out in this episode. But this really is, the driving force behind this episode really is Murphy's jealousy at not being able to get into this exclusive all-men's club. The idea of envy, of course, is nothing new. It is one of the seven deadly sins, which I'm sure you remember very well. Pride, which we discussed last time with Desperate Housewives, envy, gluttony, sloth, lust, avarice, and wrath. We're going to be talking about all of them in future podcasts here, but let's get back to the show right now. We see Murphy, and here she is really sort of expressing that idea of her envy, not being able to get in, about being excluded. One of the things that leads to sin in general, and especially the seven deadly sins, is a slight, both real and perceived. And several theologians and scholars have debated this over and over again, and how the best way to keep other people from sinning was to not sin yourself. And it was sort of this, you know, sort of this circular logic where if nobody else sinned, then you wouldn't sin because there wouldn't be anybody that would be coming upon you to sin, and then you wouldn't feel tempted to sin back at them. And it's just this whole big circle. And that's, you know, when you look at it with today's logic and when you think about, well, these sort of things happen, there's a tendency for this sort of postmodernist view that bad things are going to happen anyway and there's nothing you can do about them. But back when, you know, back during the Middle Ages, when this was very much in vogue, and when, you know, when people were really familiar with the concept of sin, it was something that you could really get your, you know, wrap your brain around. Today we might think of it as sort of the idea of, you know, it has to start somewhere. It can start with me. And we might apply that more in today's culture to something like an environmental concern, you know, or I'm going to be this one person planting a tree, or to doing charity work. I'm going to be this one person who is donating money to XYZ cause. And there, it's very much the same concept, just sort of a different take on it. Corky has never, ever been one of my favorite characters on the show. I've always found her to be sort of brash and shrill and sort of like the anti-Murphy. Growing up, I really did like this show a lot. I found it was sort of smart and funny. I found it sort of... It gave me some sort of an early jump start into sort of liberal politics, and I don't know whether you, the person listening here, are liberal or conservative, although I will note that Murphy has always been sort of a cause celeb for Diane English. She's used it to sort of further her own political ideas, sort of her own notions about what's right and what's wrong. One of the unusual things about this episode is sort of the well-mannered, well-reasoned discussion that happens on both sides of this issue, where, you know, Jim is very concerned about the tradition of the all-men's club, and Murphy is really wanting the equality, and which is going to build out there. Jim makes a very convincing argument for allowing tradition to stand. And, you know, he says at one point, this is not keeping anyone from working. This is not doing anyone any disservice. We are a private club. And, you know, really, when you think about it in those terms, he's absolutely right. Murphy makes what I consider to be a less convincing argument for standing up and why she should be allowed in. She talks about how it's discrimination and how it's not equal. And I find that, you know, I find... It's obvious for the sitcom purposes of this particular show that we're going to have to let Murphy into the club at some point. At the same time, it's not particularly convincing to me the logic by which she arrives at that point. Now, when we take into consideration when this particular show was filmed, this would have been in the late 80s. This is right after George Bush the First was elected. This was an odd time, and at the news of this day about, you know, when this particular episode is taking place, there were a couple of instances where women had been trying to get into exclusive men's-only clubs, and it wasn't something that had been a problem before then, even with the women's lib movement. You know, this was sort of this last bastion of sort of masculine separatism. At the same time, at this point, it was sort of becoming an issue with, if I remember correctly, there were women who were trying to get into the Elks clubs in various cities, you know, service organizations of that nature. A couple of exclusive clubs in New York City were coming under fire to allow women as members instead of guests. The interesting thing about this particular club is that it is so insular. There are no women here at all. Not as guests. There don't appear to be any female employees here at this particular club that Murphy is trying to get into. And that strikes me as odd. Growing up in a family where both my father and grandfather were Elks, for example, there was a women's locker room right next to the men's locker room. Women were there during all hours of the day. I believe the only times that women were not there was during lodge meetings, which I never attended as being far too young. But that was the concept of the men's club that I came away with, something where women could be brought in as an employee, they could be brought in as a guest of a member, and that seemed to me a fairly egalitarian way to go. I was also a member of the Boy Scouts, for example, and, you know, the boys had the Boy Scouts and the girls had the Girl Scouts. It never seemed to me to be that much of an issue. But around this time, there were some inroads that were starting to be made. And whether you want to call it jealousy or envy or, you know, pride, whatever you want to call it, in this particular episode, it seems fairly clear that Murphy is operating from a position of envy. She is operating from that position of jealousy. Jealousy is, of course, another name for envy, and we have a name for jealousy, or we have a concept that even young children can understand. We sort of jokingly refer to it as the green-eyed monster. That's not entirely an accident. Each of the seven deadly sins has a particular beast or demon associated with them. This is something that is sort of crops up in the sort of Judeo-Christian writings, mythology type, not strictly canonical, as in not exactly in the Bible, but things that are very influenced and things that are influencing the way that people thought and do think about things like sin and redemption and death and all that sort of stuff that sort of comes into religion as a whole. And throughout time, you know, throughout the ages, the sort of demon slash beast that was associated with envy was the Leviathan. And the Leviathan has become somewhat synonymous with a sea monster you know, you could certainly, you know, you can use your imagination and see how that might have happened. It was a leviathan in the Bible that swallowed Jonah, not a whale, although in today's Hebrew, the word leviathan does mean whale in modern Hebrew. This sort of concept of this great lurking sort of massive beast, you know, back then it would have been somewhat similar to what we might think of today as the Loch Ness Monster. And this sort of lurking just beneath the surface type of creature was how people thought about envy, something that's right there, ready to reach out and, you know, to sort of satisfy its own needs, would take what it wanted. Of course, last time we talked about how pride is the gateway sin, and we can see how envy is not entirely dissimilar. When you are jealous of something, when you covet that which is not yours, this is, you know, something that will lead you to sin in any other number of ways. And while you might not commit another deadly sin, you know, it's very easy to see how envy could lead to something like theft, could lead to certainly murder, you know. These are concepts that people have grappled with. You know, pride will lead you to the other deadly sins. Envy will lead you to other sins that are grave, if not as horrible as, you know, the seven deadly sins. The exchange that we're having right here is, again, another example of the sort of jealousy that is sort of brought out into this episode here. You know, Murphy and Jim are sparring back and forth, and it's reflected in these sort of secondary characters. What I do find amusing here is, of course, just a little gag. It's a predictable gag. It's been used in Mary Tyler Moore, any number of other shows, but they're back and everything's fine. You know, I had to comment just a little bit about that. Again, here's some topical references to the 1988 presidential election. They're talking about Michael Dukakis, the man who would be president. And it's a little odd to look back at this show and realize how, number one, how dated it is and how obviously dated it is with its sort of wardrobe and with its references to politicians of the day. At the time, however, this was something that was really, you know, very on the march. It was something that brought a lot of references into these people's homes. A lot of people had never heard of Boutros Ghali before it was mentioned on Murphy Brown, or they didn't pay attention to things like politics and, you know, certain big Washington, D.C. names until they were mentioned on Murphy Brown. And I know certainly among my generation, when Murphy Brown first started, I would have been in the fourth grade. By the time it finished up its run, I was, you know, well into high school, and it was something that we would talk about when, you know, later on, when Murphy Brown, you know, became a single mother. There was a very famous clash between her and the vice president, Dan Quayle, and that was really, we talked about that. You know, in school, we talked about that when I was in seventh or eighth grade. These are all sort of during my formative years, about, you know, how we use this show to think about politics. This was considered to be like a smart person sitcom. And today, you know, of course, the jokes are laughably dated and the clothing is worse than that of the Golden Girls. And you don't really care because you can sense there's a spark here. I will mention one thing, and I don't recall if we just saw it or not a minute ago, but the establishing shot that places Murphy Brown's house is the same as the establishing shot used for Linda Carter's house in Wonder Woman. So apparently Murphy Brown and Wonder Woman have lived in the same Washington, D.C. house, which I kind of find amusing, being a big Wonder Woman fan. That's a completely different story, and we're going to get to that a little bit later on in these Seven Deadly podcasts. But here we see a complete about-face, or we're about to see a complete about-face. We've got, as I mentioned, Charles Kimbrough as Jim Dial, about to make a rather convincing argument as to why men's clubs should be allowed. And he talks about this idea of sanctity and about security. And it's interesting to note that this is something that would have appealed very much to the original architects of the Seven Deadly Sins. And although this is a concept, these seven grave sins, although this is a concept that is, you know, millennia old, when it really came into vogue again was during the Middle Ages. And this idea of a safe haven, this idea of a sort of sancto sanctorum, that's something that really would have appealed to the theologians of the Middle Ages, you know, for various reasons. But number one is that this was a time when monasteries and convents were all over the place, and where they were sort of seen as the last great bastion of where God resides, where churches were thought to be the sanctuaries. And by sanctuary, we're not using it to refer to in the sort of vague secular sense, but as this place safe, where you were safe, where you could seek refuge from the law in a church, where you could escape evil, and evil would not be able to enter the church. You know, people who were unclean were not allowed to pass over the threshold. And this idea, whether it's an exclusive, gender-exclusive club or not, this idea of a sanctuary is really something that would have appealed to people writing and thinking about sin and mortality and faith during the Middle Ages. Murphy's argument here about being allowed to join and being equal is, as I said, somewhat less than convincing, but it is still delivered well. And she does make a solid point about how she should be given the same chance as everyone else. And she says, she says, because they gave me a fair shot, you know, and that's how I got onto the softball team. Here we've got sort of, you know, it's a sitcom turn. This is something that plagues many sitcoms during the first season. And it's odd to find the few that don't sort of fall prey to this, but you've got this very rigid act structure, and, you know, boom, 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 and we're setting up a problem, and we're going to resolve it after the commercial break. And, you know, here Jim's, you know, just moments before, we just saw Jim's, you know, signing her paper, and now she's into the club. And we find out that she's sort of has blackmailed her way in, and of course this is all handled with a joke, and it's all very ha-ha. But here we find sort of another facet of envy. And Murphy Brown has now achieved what she has envied. She now has that which she has coveted. And in a predictable sense, it's clear to see where this is going next. She now has that which she has longed for. However, because she has it, the simple act of her ownership makes it not as desirable to anyone else, and in turn, that will make it not desirable to her as well. And we can see this is very much like a medieval morality play, where we have the central protagonist wanting something, and when that person gets what they were after, we see that it was not desirable to begin with, and Aesop would have called that sour grapes, but in the, you know, in sort of the language and in sort of the structure of the medieval morality play that we're watching unfold here, we see in a very real sense that this is not about sour grapes because it was something that was wonderful. It is that the time has come, you know, that the moment has passed, and we see, you know, how the simple act of her ownership has made it, you know, pass away from something that is cool and exciting and gets all these great guests to something that's going to leave her and Jim sitting in an empty bar. I do find this amusing, this little exchange between this man and Murphy. You know, he turns out to be a shoe polisher, a shoe shiner, and, you know, he's the only one who shows her any warmth, you know, and then, you know, he says, you know, he says appearance is very important here. You know, so what do you say? I put a nice polish on those shoes. You know, and she's, you know, oh, no, no, gosh, you know, you're my friend. You know, she's thinking, and then, you know, yeah, he walks, bitch. You know, this is, again, it's a predictable sitcom moment, but it's a cute little turn. Yeah, Murphy Brown has always used sarcasm, and I'm not talking about specifically the character, but the show in general, although the character herself has, you know, certainly her moments of sarcastic wit. I love how Jim is always coming to the rescue for Murphy. You know, he says, I think you should show her as much respect, and then that response is just terrific. Cram it, Dial. You know, whatever. Jim here makes, again, a very eloquent defense of Murphy. And I find it interesting in this particular episode that Jim gives three very eloquent, very well-meant, very well-said arguments about his point of view. Two of them are in defense of the exclusive men's club. You know, in those two sort of impassioned speeches, he talks very poignantly about, you know, this is our right. This is a private place. And then he says, you know, this is our, you know, this is our sanctity, you know, this is our sanctuary. This is our sacred sort of tree fort. And then here he gives a very eloquent defense of Murphy, you know, talking about how courageous she is and what a terrific journalist and how if they don't like it, they can leave. And of course, you know, all three of his arguments are sort of just simply rejected. First by Murphy, and then by these other members of the club. I do find it kind of cute here to watch Charles Kimbrough and Candace Bergen sort of singing and dancing. Charles Kimbrough, you may or may not know, has appeared on Broadway in a couple of well-known Stephen Sondheim musicals, Company in the 1970s, and Sunday in the Park with George, the Pulitzer Prize-winning musical of the 1980s. And, you know, both of them he had, you know, featured roles. He wasn't, you know, the star of the show by any stretch of the imagination, but they were pretty memorable featured roles. And it's amusing to watch him singing here, you know, in a context that is so far removed from the Broadway stage, and still being able to watch him sort of, you know, sing and dance and put on the show. Candace Bergen, although she got to sing a lot in Murphy Brown, does not have an especially great voice, but the character was so winning. You know, her father was such a great entertainer. Edgar Bergen was a very famous ventriloquist, and, you know, he had his dummy, Charlie McCarthy. Candace, I believe, devoted an entire chapter of her autobiography to talking about the sibling rivalry she felt with this sort of wooden dummy, Charlie McCarthy. And I haven't, that might be apocryphal. I don't want to, you know, put it out there as fact, but, you know, this is what I've come to understand. I haven't actually read the book, her autobiography, myself. In any event, neither here nor there, we're seeing what happens when you let sin get the better of you. You know, this is a very tightly structured morality play. This is the type of entertainment that would be presented to peasant folk during the Middle Ages. And, you know, we see what happens with sin. We see what happens when you become too jealous. We see what happens when you covet. And when you get what you want, you see that it really isn't what you wanted in the first place. In any event, I thank you for listening to me, and I hope you've learned a little bit. And on behalf of Smart TV, visit us more often. Thanks.